This is BBC Radio. Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with P.P. Arnold.
Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time here on BBC Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. Musicians' importance shouldn't be measured against their commercial success or how immediately recognisable they are. A musician's worth is measured in their talent, sometimes by the respect they get from their contemporaries, and other times by their commitment to their art, their ability to find their voice and refusal to stop expressing themselves, no matter how hard that might get. If we're to judge how significant this week's guest is by those standards, then she's a very, very important artist indeed. An American soul singer who found herself catapulted into swinging London in the 60s. She's been and remains a musical hero to many famous artists. I'm very pleased to welcome to The First Time, P.P. Arnold. In this interview, we hear about how, in her teens, her voice and a chance encounter led her to become one of the Ikettes, the legendary backing singers with Ike and Tina Turner. And she talks about how she cut her teeth on the famous US chitling circuit. And that's the start of her incredible musical journey that involves her first trip to London in 66 to support the Rolling Stones, friendships with Jagger and Hendrix and the Small Faces, and two iconic 60s LPs. And what follows is one of the most remarkable careers in music, as over 50 years, P.P.'s voice was sought out by Rod Stewart and Barry Gibb and Eric Clapton and Nick Drake and Peter Gabriel and Roger Waters, the KLF, Paul Weller, Ocean Colour Scene and Primal Scream, all of whom gravitated towards her style, her poise and, of course, that voice. And we try and cover all that in this show. And, of course, we bring it up to date with a new album, her first in five decades, The New Adventures of P.P. Arnold. But the first question I ask her, as I do with all my guests, is when was she first aware of music? As a child.
Wow, well, that would have to be really two. I mean, I'm sure it was before then because my parents always kept the radio going. KGFJ was the radio station of the time. Soul, blues, you know, I was surrounded by music, gospel, because my family, I was born into a family of gospel singers, so... You know, gospel was the music and the radio was always playing and, you know, the cousins were coming by and B.B. King would be on the turntable and my grandmother, Big Mama, loved Mahalia Jackson.
Until gone, oh, nobody. One of these days, oh Lord, one of these days, yes, I'm going.
Yeah, so I would have to say two and probably before, but I can remember two because I got in trouble when I was two.
What happened?
My family were having like a get-together. My family are from Texas and they moved to L.A. So this is like in the late 40s, mid-40s. And so when a lot of family was moving from Texas to the West Coast to get away from all the racism and stuff in the South. And so as cousins would arrive, they would all kind of come to our house and there'd be like barbecue and everybody would be like, you know, playing cards and dominoes and, you know. The after church. This all took place after church. And so, yeah, so my father and my uncle were really good dancers. And they had a cousin, my cousin, their cousin Otis. And Otis had just come from Texas. And they were all partying and they were all dancing and everything. And my grandfather had a younger sister who had taught me a few bad words that I shouldn't have been saying. And so they were all partying, and the party was going on, and the dancing, and this cousin sort of let out this bad word that was one of my favorites. That so, yeah, so this bad word came out of my mouth, because I thought it was everybody else. When he said it, everybody was like, yeah, laughing and everything. But when I said it, my father did not think it was funny. So I got in trouble. And that's the first time I remember getting smacked. And it was at this party where, you know, B.B. King and everybody else was just like on the turntable.
There's nothing else to lose. I'm gonna count my twos. I'm taking off my shoes. My baby's coming home. My baby's coming home. When I first heard this boy, I did the twist. My baby's coming home. The things I did before that made a go, I ain't gonna do no more. And I'm telling you so. My baby's coming home. My baby's coming home. When I first got a wife, boy, I thought I would die. My baby's coming home. I'm eating all the planes, I'm eating all the trains. I'm checking on the bus, boy, I'm kicking up a fuss. My baby's coming home. My baby's coming home. If she was coming back to you, boy, you'd be a fool too. My baby's coming home.
Can you remember the first time you sung in public? I guess that would have been church.
That would have been church.
Yeah.
I was 4 years old.
Only 4 years old?
I was 4 years old. I had my first solo, and it was Soldiers in the Army. My mother was a soldier. She had her hands on the gospel pile. But one day she got old. She thought she couldn't fight anymore, but she said, I'm gonna stand up and fight on anyhow. So that was my first solo, and everybody in the church started shouting. You know,
really?
there was me, this little girl, and everybody was shouting, and I got really excited. And that sort of like let me know that when I sang, it made people happy.
Mm.
So, because when you shout in church, that means you got happy.
Talking about gospel, we should mention Mavis Staples.
Mavis.
Who's been a guest on this show.
And who I met last summer.
How was that?
I met her. It was fantastic. I did two festivals with Mavis last year. And at the first one, I got off stage, and Mavis, you know, we were backstage, and everybody had, we all had our mobile dressing rooms and everything, and I came off stage and took off my clothes to run to where Mavis was going to be playing, and everybody goes like, you can't get through there, you can't get through, it was packed solid, she was in this big tent, and I just sort of, it was like Moses and the Red Sea opened up. And I just made my way right to the front of that stage, and I stood right there, and I just watched her, and I just, like, my heart, my soul, it was just like a dream come true. And afterwards, I went backstage, so I stood outside of her, I knocked on her door, and her manager came to the door and said, well, Mavis can't see anybody right now, Mavis is having her dinner. So I said, okay, I'll wait. I sat outside and I waited and I waited, and I just sort of like, I thought, I'm going to knock again. So I'm going to knock on the door again. And our manager said, well, Mavis hasn't finished eating yet, but I could see Mavis in the corner. And I sort of said, hi, Mavis. I said, I just want to come in and hug you and let you know how much I love you. And that I've loved you all my life, and it's just like such an honor to be able to meet you. And yeah, so she said, come on in. So I went in and I met her and I hugged her and I let her know how much I loved her and how I loved her all my life, you know, the Staple Singers, and, you know, growing up listening to them, and to meet her, it was just such an honor. It was just like one of my dreams come true. And we took pictures together, so I have photos with Mavis and everything. And then I saw her on the second festival, and I didn't get a chance to spend any more time with her. But while she was on stage, and she saw me, I was in the front, she goes, PB, you should be doing this festival. And I go, Mavis, I already did my set. So it was great. I've made a really good connection with her.
It's really interesting because you've got the way that Aretha took gospel and moved it into a soul direction, and Mavis took gospel into a kind of folk direction, and you took gospel into a kind of the British R&B direction. You all took that source and went in different ways, didn't you?
Yeah, but they knew what they were doing. I had no idea, you know. I never had a plan, or I didn't know who I was musically. I was just this girl who loved to sing, that sang in church. And then all these opportunities, you know, like, came to me. It's like the universe just kind of took me out of a place where I was in the wrong place and put me where I should have been.
This is a story that you get asked about a lot. We've kind of got to go there. You know, we've got to talk about Ike and Tina, because it's like you weren't looking for that. But music was looking for you. And it found you. Can you tell me a bit about first meeting them? I know.
It was a great day. It was a great day that really changed my life, you know, because it started with a prayer. I was in this abusive teen marriage. It was awful. And I just, one morning, I was married. I'm 17. I have two kids. I'm working two jobs. It's like, you know, hey, wasn't the life that my parents had planned for me, that's for sure. So I said this prayer and I asked God to show me a way out of this life that I had brought on by myself. I took responsibility. I knew that nobody had twisted my arm. I just said my prayer and I was just in the house getting on with my chores. And an hour later, the phone rang and it's Maxine Smith. Maxine Smith was an ex-girlfriend of my brother Ronnie's, and she was a singer. And she was like, she had a boyfriend who like produced and wrote songs for Bobby Day, the Rockin' Robin guy. She goes, hey, you gotta come, you gotta help us. We got this audition, and this other girl who was also an ex-girlfriend of my brother's hadn't turned up. She said, we're coming to get you. They wouldn't take no for an answer. Next thing I know, 30 minutes later, she turns up at my door. I lie to my husband and tell him that I'm going shopping. And I go out the house and down the road, and there's this Cadillac Broham that's going to take us to Icantina's house. I tell the driver, hurry, 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 go, 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 go. My husband sees me getting in this car, I'm in big trouble. He goes like, you got a husband? You know, like I was only 17 and I looked about 12, as you can see on those first lady pictures. And I go like, yeah, I got a husband and two kids. Go. So next thing I know, I'm in Ike and Tina Turner's living room singing, dancing in the streets. Tina goes, right, girls, you got the gig. And I go like, oh, no, not me. Not me. I got to go home. My husband's not going to be happy with me. Tina goes, well, if you're going to get in trouble for nothing, why don't you ride with us to Fresno tonight and at least see the gig and get in trouble for something? And I went to Fresno with them and saw this most amazing woman on stage and the whole review, Ike Turner and the Kings of Rhythm, and then the Ikeettes came on and did their thing. And then Tina came on stage and all hell broke loose. You know, and it was just like, wow. And they had one of those flicker lights, you know, and they came off stage doing the shag. We always come off doing the shag on Tell the Truth. And wow, it was just like incredible. From the first time I saw her till once she finally found her freedom, you know, and became the most incredible, simply the best female entertainer of our times.
He gets me in the dark and he says he's my man, but when we walk down the street, he never holds a hand. He said one day that he will marry me, but he tells his friends that that will never be. Before I get home, then he wants to hug and kiss on me. Everybody's sleeping and no one can see.
BBC Radio 6
Music. Very brave of you to do that. Very brave to go leaving abusive relationships. It's hard. And to commit to going, right, this is a new life, I'm going out there. At that age, where's that come from with you? Is that the way you were brought up? Is that just you and music? How did you find the strength to do that?
I was just determined not to stay in that relationship, and that's why I had said that prayer that morning. And, you know, it's like God answered my prayer, because I think if I had stayed in that relationship, I might not be alive.
Really?
Yeah, it was really bad. You know, either he was going to kill me or I was going to kill him. you know, because like I just wasn't having it anymore. I had got to that point, you know, because I'd seen abusive relationships. I mean, that's the way it was back in those days, you know. Even my mother and my aunts, and you know, I've seen that, and I didn't have that personality to just take that, just to continue, stay with somebody just because you're married to them. And I was always quite strong. I was a strong spirit, you know, because I had survived. My parents had 6 kids. There was a lot of tragedy in our family. So there was no room for me to be a child. I was the second child, and I always sort of felt like I had to help my mother. That's where I think my strength came from, and you know, that opportunity came, and I didn't leave my husband straight away. I went on tour, you know, because I was very young, and I was very introverted, and I was very shy. It was awful, you know, because, you know, sometimes you're in those kind of relationships and you're told that you're ugly and things like that, you know. I always thought all the other girls were cuter than me and all of that, and I had no idea. I look back at some of those pictures in the 60s, I go like, girl, you were like fine.
Yeah. But this is true.
I didn't really. I wasn't into me like that. I was to me. It was a way for me to work and support me and my kids. So I went out on that first tour, and when I came back, and the abuse continued, then I had to leave. I had to for my safety. And so then from there, you know, that's the first time that I was free in my life, you know, because I hadn't really been a teenager. I'd missed all my teenage thing. But, you know, I had brothers and sisters, so I you know, I knew, but I hadn't been a teenager. So when I came to England with Icantina, wow, swing in London. It was great. And, you know, the music, the whole scene, it was such a new thing. Everybody was really shocked in the review because I was like the quiet, introverted, shy one. And then suddenly I'm hanging out in discotheques with Mick Jagger. You know what I mean? It's like, you didn't do that. That wouldn't have happened in America. My career as P.P. Arnold would not have happened in America. You end up being controlled by somebody or other. That's why, you know, Tina, in those days, women were controlled by men. So most of those women were in abusive relationships. You know, I remember checking into a hotel. We're checking in. Tina's got a black eye, you know, and somebody else is coming out with a black eye. You know, that's the way it was. It was awful. It was an awful time. So for me to come to England and to suddenly be an artist.
You look at a lot, that era, a lot of guys, a lot of boys in bands, lots of young, successful men with the kind of ego and the arrogance. And there wasn't that many women in that scene.
That's right.
Because, you know, guys like to peacock and it's all that, the clothes and the fame and Top of the Pops.
Yep.
Whereas you, they like you and you fitted in and you were an equal. You never seemed like, you know, a wallflower girl singer. You were front and center.
Kind of.
Yeah.
My performance skills had come from working with Tina. And Tina sort of like instilling in me, listen, you cannot be shy on this stage. You know, you have to come out. So like I was just learning that period, immediate records period, we were a family, like Motown, you know, in the States, and all the writers everybody would come to the office, and that's how I first met the Small Faces at the office, you know. And then we just hit it off. Steve and I hit it off.
Why do you think you hit it off?
I think that they were really into my sound, you know, the gospel. They were into, because I was young like them, I guess they could kind of like experience what it was like being a black American. Everybody would really be excited about me showing up at the studio. Just this thing, it was this authenticity. that I had that I think that everybody was able to get close to. You know, I was like the young black girl on the block.
I do have to ask about First Cut is the Deepest, because if you're lucky in a career as a singer, you maybe have a song like that.
It was a blessing for me to get that. What we used to do, you know, like in the old days, you would have like listening sessions. And so we would go to the office, which was always great, and have a listening session. And Dick James Publishers were right next door to Immediate. And so Mike Hurst, who had been in the Springfields with Dusty Springfield and her brother, he was now producing, and he was producing Cat Stevens. And so Cat Stevens lived right around the corner from all the stuff is happening just around the corner from Denmark Street, you know, where all the musicians used to meet. And so Steve's father had a Greek restaurant that was right around the corner, and he had a really cool, you know, penthouse little flat above where his father lived and everything. He was such a nice guy.
He was a beautiful boy.
He was a beautiful boy, but beautiful boy inside and out. He was a serious young man as well, very talented, very creative. So Mike Hurst gave the song to Andrew. There's a story that somebody says that I bought the song. I wish I had it. That is really not the truth. I don't know what the deal went down. I didn't know anything about deals in those days or whatever. All I know is that they played me this song, and I loved it.
Straight away?
I love that song because the lyric, I would have given you all of my heart, but there's someone who's torn it apart. I had lived that.
I would have given you all of my heart, but there's someone who's torn it apart. And he's taking almost all that I've got. But if you wanna try to love again, baby, try to love again. But I know first cut is the deepest. Baby, I know first cut is the deepest.
This is The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and that is the beautiful The First Cut is the Deepest, written by Cat Stevens, and the first hit for my guest this week, P.P. Arnold.
This is BBC Radio
6 Music.
6 Music.
There'll be no strings to bind your hands, not if my love can't bind your
just call me.
and it won't matter anyhow. If morning's echoes says we've sinned, well, it was what I wanted now.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we look at the key first moments in an artist's career. And my guest this week is P.P. Arnold. And that was a classic single, Angel of the Morning, from 1968, which came out on the iconic Immediate record label. However, Immediate folded in 1970, leaving P.P. without a record company. And many of the recordings she did in the aftermath of Immediate were never actually released, only surfacing in 2017 on the brilliant Turning Tide compilation album. 2017 it came out, and it's amazing to think so many of those recordings weren't released at the time. You kind of think, but these are great, these deserve to be heard, and it's brilliant they're out there now because they deserve a big audience. But it must have been, I can't imagine, like, getting those down on tape then going, what, they're not coming out?
Well, that's happened to me a lot.
Yeah, it has.
In the industry. But when it first happened back then, you know, it was really sad that Immediate folded like it did. Once again, you know, politics and business that I knew nothing about. Suddenly you're a part of this whole family of music. That was my musical home. But when Immediate went into liquidation, everybody went off their separate ways. Everybody else knew. They knew what the industry was in England, how it, you know, I hadn't had that experience of being English and being in the business and knowing all who did this and who was that person and who, you know, so I was just on my own. Everybody just, wow, went their separate ways. And I met this guy named Jim Morris. And Jim just sort of like took a liking to me. And he was a lovely man. I actually married him and later. And he was very close to Barry. And so the Bee Gees had split up at that time. And when Barry found out that Jim was seeing me, Barry wanted to meet me. Because he was, he always liked my version of To Love Somebody. So Jim introduced me to Barry, and he had just met Linda, his wife. And so we just became friends. We were like, you know, like couples. And Barry was like, he just wanted to go in the studio. And all these politics were going on in his camp. So he just started writing songs for me. And we were both sort of like at a crossroads. You got no money. Robert Stigwood was his manager. Barry, like, talked Robert into managing me. Now, Robert wasn't really happy about Barry working with me, right? Because Robert wanted to get the brothers back together, understandably. Barry was, like, exerting his...
authority.
His authority at that time. So, suddenly I have a manager, but I have a manager that's not really into me.
Yeah.
And so, but we never really had a relationship with one another. And then when the Bee Gees got back together, he wasn't really interested in those tracks coming out. I think the Bee Gees recorded some of those tracks later. That was the first time those songs were recorded. And yeah, and I was just devastated that they didn't get released, that they were just, everything just stopped. With Barry and I, some politics went down and the tracks were just put on a shelf.
Stevie Wonder. When did you first fall in love with the music of Stevie Wonder?
Oh, baby, everything is all right. Uptight, out of sight. You know, 12-year-old genius.
This is true.
You know, it's part of my life. All these artists, you know, Mavis Staples, part of my life. Stevie Wonder, part of my life. And then I finally met him in 1970? And I get a call from Madeline Bell one morning. And Madeline says, "Hey, Pat, you want to go do a Stevie Wonder session?" I go like, "You bet your ass I do." So, yeah. So next thing, then we go to the hotel and we meet Stevie and his lovely wife at the time, Sarita Wright, and he was doing a gig at the Talk of the Town. Signed, sealed, delivered, "I'm Yours" was out. So he wanted us to sing "Signed, Sealed, Delivered, I'm Yours" with him every night. So, so yeah, what else you want, Stevie? During that time, I was just going through a transformation, you know, because you had seen me with Ike and Tina Ikeats with the long hair and everything, and then, and the wigs. So the wigs were a whole part of P.P. Arnold, right? The whole different wigs and that whole thing. But I came out of the studio one night with Barry and everybody, and I just took my wig off and put it in the trash can. And everybody, because my friends hadn't seen me, I just felt that they had, I just felt that I was just being false. I cut my hair short, you know, because wearing wigs is just like really, really messed up my hair. So I had a short afro. So suddenly I got a short afro, and I had already done the Kafunta album, so I was moving it to my sort of, you know, African roots, you know, James Brown, it did, I'm black and I'm proud. Now that changed the way people looked at me for a while. You know, because suddenly little Pipiano was like short afros, Angela Davis posters on the wall, which I was like still in touch with what was going on in America with blacks. But I was in England, and I had been this little dolly bird.
Looking at the work you did in the 80s, what I like about seeing it is because it's musically, it's everywhere.
Mm.
There's Peter Gabriel, there's the Beatmasters, there's KLF, there's Alternate, there's working with Roger Waters, but your voice is threading all these things together. People still wanted that voice, and you've still got it. It's still, the quality of your voice is maintained. And all these people in the 80s, this thing and this thing and this thing, they wanted your voice and they sought you out. And after the 70s being that tough, I'm sure it wasn't easy doing sessions. That must have felt like, okay, this thing, this talent I have.
My focus was on surviving and looking after my sons. You know, I had, my oldest son was in university, had to keep him in university, I had a young son, Kojo. So it was like I had to find my way.
It was work.
It was work. And so I was trying to survive. And I met this woman who runs the agency at Universal, who books bit parts and extra work and everything. So I started doing that. I just saved money, get back to England. And that's what I did. I thought, I can't, LA is not for me. Never been for me since I was a child, and it's not for me.
There's this lovely thing happens in the 90s where these people start to kind of rediscover you. Or people that loved you think, we can get her now. We've got a bit of fame. We can get her on board. And that could be Primal Scream or it could be Ocean Calycine. That must have felt good.
That felt great.
Of course it did.
That felt great because I really wanted to be an artist in my own right.
Mm.
And as you know, when I came back, I did lots of different things. When I came back to England, was the right place for me to come back to, and the 80s, and I came back on roller skates. I came back, and the first thing I did when I came back, well, I did that song with the Kane Gang, and then I got Starlight Express, and from Starlight Express, I got a deal with 10 Records. I started doing some stuff on 10, did another musical once on this island, which won the Olivier Awards and everything, but still not connecting. Ocean Color Scene arrived backstage at the theater, at the Birmingham Refugee Theater, where we were with lovely bouquet of flowers and everything, wanted me to go to the studio with them that night, but I couldn't because we were going back to London. But that was my first introduction to Ocean Color Scene and Steve Craddock. And then around that time, I first started writing my book. I thought, that's what I need to do. I need to start writing this down. And when I started writing, as soon as I started writing about my experiences with the small faces, all these people came out of the woodwork. You know, suddenly there's this small faces tribute thing happening, and people are starting to give the small faces the props that they deserve, and all these people. So I met all of these lovely, lovely people, as well as working with for that tribute album. I did Understanding with the Primals. And that was great fun.
They're very good fun.
They were great. They were great fun. I love that session. Oh, that was so good. Those guys, you know, being Scottish, they're all Scottish, and they love to drink. After a few drinks, I couldn't understand a word they were saying. But we had fun, and we made a great record. That's really a good record. So anyway, I put together a band, and I called it PP and the Band of Angels. And I did 2 sellout gigs at the Jazz Cafe. And after those gigs, I get a call. I get a call from Mark Finnick, who's Roger Waters' manager. And Mark says, PP, Roger's been looking for you. Where have you been? Because I had been underground. I had really been underground. I had, after all the Beatmasters and the KLF stuff and all that stuff that happened, I went through a bankruptcy and I lost my house and I was underground and I was just like, I didn't know where I was for a long time. So I had worked with Roger in 92 on the Amused to Death album. And Roger was getting ready to go on the road to do the first In the Flesh tour. So he wanted me to go because, you know, I sing that song Perfect Sense with him. And I don't think he can find nobody else to sing Perfect Sense like that. He said, Mama, Mama, the president's a fool. Why do I have to keep reading this technical manual? And the joint is a step and the purpose on Wall Street said, don't make a slap. Is for fools. Man is a tool in the hands of the great God Almighty. And they gave him command of a nuclear submarine. Sent him back, search of the Garden of Eden. And I thought, well, I would do one tour and kind of get myself together and I'd be able to put my own thing together. But I ended up doing with Roger from 1999 to 2008. I did 3 In the Flesh tours with him and 3 Dark Side of the Moon tours, and it was wonderful. You know, working with Roger was just a great experience. It gave me the opportunity to perform globally for the first time, you know, first class traveling set, you know, and it was just great. It was just brilliant. And so in 2008, that was, he didn't do a tour for a while. And so I thought, well, this is my chance to, like, you know, try to do me again. You know, I was able to save a lot when I was with Roger. So I started investing in myself. You know, I just became this independent artist, still believing that somewhere there's a place for me.
How does it feel listening to this new record?
I love it. I love this record.
Because it's got tones and genres and styles from kind of almost everywhere.
Steve and I knew we were a good fit in the beginning, in the 90s. It was like, you know...
You could tell.
Yeah. Because we just had a good connection, musical connection. You know, our love of Steve Marriott had kind of brought us together. And so he, like, understood me. He understood P.P. Arnold. And he wanted me to get back to being me. And so he loved that essence of the 60s. And he loved my voice, and I love working with him because he's so creative and he's just like a cool guy. He just knows music. He's just listened to so much music and everything. So for me, it's great being around people like Steve, because I spend a lot of time in Spain. I live alone, and I'm kind of out of the loop. And you're told, you know, your age, you know, the whole ageism thing, fighting, all of those kind of things, and still not having that support system behind you. So when Steve and Sally moved to Devon, Steve, like, put his studio together, and he started listening to, like, all of his tapes and everything, and he found the stuff that we had been doing, and he just gives me a call. And he goes, we need to finish this. And I go, like, yep, we sure do. And then Paul Weller, he's just been such a support for the whole album. He helped with the Turning Tide, giving us all the studio space and everything to mix that. And then he's given me another gift with If I Were Your Picture, the picture song that's on the album. And he's actually singing on the end. I wanted him to sing a little bit more. So maybe I will do something else and we'll do a duet together. I love Paul. He's great. He's a great, great, great. He's a mod father. And they've started calling me the mod mother. So the mod father has, like, really, really, really been supportive and helped the mod mother, you know, regenerate and come back to life.
A mod mother. I love that. The final thing. What song should we finish on?
Ah.
It's up to you. I choose something off a new record, but it's up to you.
Why don't we just, like, choose the single? Baby Blue. I love it.
Then that's the song we'll finish on. Thank you so much. It's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Six of the best words you could ever hear him say. A symphony fell from his lips. Compared to earlier tunes he'd knocked together quick. Instead of meeting you,
This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Cigarettes and alcohol in your lifetime, if you're lucky.
Straight up bangers, obscure gems, and long forgotten favourites. Every emotion has a sound to it.
You just gotta do you.
This is Alt 90s on BBC Sounds.
B-boy.